You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
On Deck Business Loans for up to $250,000. Apply in just minutes. Go to ondeck.com.au today.
Dwayne's World with Dwayne Russell.
Always great to have your company for Dwayne's World for On Deck Business Loans up to $250,000. The number one medico in the business, Dr. Peter Larkins, has been good enough to join us in between consultations. Doc, great to have you on. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dwayne. Always nice to talk with you.
So I won't keep you long because I know you've probably got a couple of patients in the waiting room ready to go. The news today, how surprising was...
I'm listening to you at the moment.
Cheerio. Well, to all of you in the waiting room, you're seeing the best in the business. It's worth the wait. I've sat in there and read those magazines too. And check out the latest house magazine that he's got there. There's some great renovations you can do on your own home. Peter, were you surprised by the news last night?
I'm sort of surprised it took this long to go public, Dwayne.
Right.
I mean, the illicit drug policy is, you know, a confidential program that all 18 clubs have been using since 2005, and the self-reporting by a player where he can come to me if I'm the club doctor and say, oh, you know, geez, Doc, I think I went off track last night at my mate's birthday. That's been around for at least a decade. And so the intention there was to try to get behind why the player had taken cocaine, ecstasy, MMDA, whatever he'd taken. And this was the no punishment program. It was the medical welfare program. Sam's covered off most of my good points here, Sam. But so the issue, you know, it's been happening for a long, long time, not just at Melbourne. Now, Melbourne maybe has had a few more, and that needs to come out as to whether there was repeat offenders. But any player, and there's been many clubs that have had a player come to them and be self-reported, be tested midweek, tested for an illicit, and then not allowed to play. And then, unfortunately, this is where the ethical dilemma for the doctors is really they've struggled with, Dwayne. Then an excuse has to be a reason for withdrawing them from Saturday's or Friday's or Sunday's game. And that's often they're managed, they pull a hamstring, they have a back spasm. And that's where it's been tricky. But at the end of the day, the doctor is required confidentially to protect the player's medical information from the coach and from the AFL.
So what will change, do you think, when they redo this policy? Do you think that players will accept having their name put out there and be happy to accept that I'm missing because of this problem that I've got when I'm getting it treated?
No way. No way. I cannot for 1 minute think that I think you alluded to it before, that the actual honest reason for a player missing this Friday night is going to be because they've tested positive to cocaine on Thursday. I mean, you know, so it's the solution is not easy as to where we go next. And so the issue is, you know, do we have one code only? Because this is not the WADA code. This is not the performance code. This is the so-called welfare code, which has intercepted people that have gone off track and put them on the straight and narrow, and they've had counselling and drug rehabilitation, and no one's ever heard about it in the media. Now, the issue I've got is, you know, if we take it away, we don't test for them, you don't know about it, they're going to turn up on a weekend and get tested potentially, and then we've got the Joel Smith situation again, Dwayne. Or we're just going to have a rampant, you know, and again, we're not saying it's not in society, but I don't have a solution for that. This is going to be more discussions during the season, both at AFL medical level and AFL administrative level, and Players Association, the third wheel there.
The number one doctor in the land, Dr. Peter Larkins, has been good enough to stick around. So, Doc, yes, the self-reporting system that we've got now stops or helps stop a player playing with an illegal drug in their system. Are we at more danger of having a heart attack or something go wrong if we allow a player to play with an illegal substance in their system and then get caught by WADA post-game?
The answer is yeah, the potentials are, depending on which illicit substance we're talking about, and the primary ones are stimulants. So we're talking cocaine, amphetamine base, where your heart rate goes up, your alertness goes up, but it also does affect your blood pressure. It does affect your ability to lose heat in perspiration and heat dissipation. So overheating and things can happen. So arguably, not a heart attack, but a heart rhythm problem would be the more the way I'd express it, Dwayne, where they might get an arrhythmia or a tachycardia or go into some sort of rhythm problem that we've seen in certain players, plus the exhaustion from not realising you're fatigued, and plus the heat stress, you know, in the early parts or the latter part when the weather's warm. So they're all the dangers of playing if it's a high enough. I mean, if you took something on a Tuesday, Wednesday, you're going to have a low level in by Saturday. If you took it on a Friday night, you're at higher risk. So that's the simple answer. They're mostly amphetamines, and therefore there is a risk in vulnerable people for sure. And, you know, do they performance enhance? It's always an argument. I think they do because of what I just said. They're stimulants. Mm. So alertness, reflexes, you know, hand-eye coordination all go up if you're on an adrenaline-like drug.
So there's one here on the text. I actually think the AFL and the players have a world-leading approach to early intervention and harm minimisation. That's from Bill in Hobart. Is where do you see this policy the AFL's got, the voluntary policy, as opposed to the way other sports run their sport?
Yeah, well, it's always been lauded as world-leading. And I remember when it was introduced and having discussions, if you remember the famous Dr. Harry Unglick, who was the medical advisor, and Peter Harcourt were there at the time, and Andrew Demetriou. And so it was world-leading best intervention policy. So there weren't many sports around the world. Obviously, even, you know, American sports don't even subscribe to WADA like the American football and NBA doesn't. But in terms of a voluntary policy where players were willingly submitting, it was certainly an innovation. It was always fraught with danger. I was never a three-strike fan. I felt that was very flawed because it gave people too many times to transgress and not get into trouble. Now it's a two-strike policy, which you'd argue is better. But the testing isn't that regularly or that thorough. So players do roll the dice knowing they're going to get away with it. So it's not a perfect policy, but certainly it was innovative, and it was certainly well backed by the drug and counselling services saying it was a good thing.
Hmm. And legally, if the AFL wipes this policy away now and a player does play with a substance and injures himself or injures someone else, I mean, I know you're not a man with legal background, but that could be an issue too.
Well, that's Andrew Dillon's legal background coming in there, yes, of course, Dwayne, but the answer is, you know, are you voluntarily exposing yourself to a risk that you didn't need to because you played with it with a substance that you weren't allowed to? So I think as a non-lawyer, I'd really say, gee, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to blame the club or the AFL if you sustained an injury because the AFL didn't test you prior to the game and stopped playing. So that really is drawing a long bow, and I wouldn't buy into that.
And doctors do have to keep their patients' issues confidential, even from partners and kids and all that kind of stuff, even though the doctor might think it's in the best interest of the patient to divulge it. Obviously, if they get asked not to, they don't.
Yeah, this is the ethical, you know, challenge of the doctor. Who are they responsible to? Well, you know, in all the medical world and medical insurances and medical defence, it's the patient. The patient's the player. It's not the club or the coach or the AFL or the league. So the doctors have an ethical responsibility to do the best thing they can by that player's knee injury, that player's shoulder injury, that player's concussion, or in this case, their mental health or drug transgressions. And so they're not supposed to discuss it. It's signed off as a particular contract between AFL-PA and the players, as you know, voluntarily. And the doctors have bought into that since 2005, as I repeat myself, Dwayne. So, and you're not supposed to talk about it. I mean, you hear rumours, and there are occasions, you know, where you hear about players but are missing for, I wonder why, because you don't know they're injured. But it's never been discussed in the public forum until in Parliament. And again, it's because of this Melbourne dilemma, which is quite extensive. It goes well beyond what Dr. Z Rain has been saying.
Mm. And what do doctors report to their CEO or to the AFL? Do they report a number at the end of the year? Do they report we've had three voluntary?
Yeah. Well, it's more of a league report rather than a club by club. So it's even de-identified as a club. So the league is curious to know if the system's working naturally, because you have to decide if it's worth doing. And so there is a confidential de-identified by club and obviously by player name to say, look, we've had, let's make up a number, Dwayne. We've had 15 interceptions this year where players who self-reported or were caught in the illicit press testing and had a first strike where it doesn't get into the media publicly. And so the AFL wants to know that its system has been effective. And hence, because it happens every year, and I mean every year, players get caught and it doesn't go public, the AFL would say it's worked. And they'd say that they've got some people back on track because they've entered a rehabilitation program, they've entered a counselling program. The real problem is the repeat offenders, as I said, and this is where it remains to be seen whether certain clubs have had, you know, you could put your hand up every second week, Dwayne, say I'm doing them. They're the ones that I'm really concerned about, but the genuine ones the AFL wants to know about, but they don't get the player's name or they don't know club by club.
So the doctor, each 18 club doctors anonymously give the AFL their number, but the AFL doesn't know where that, which club that number came from.
But to my understanding, that's right. So the AFL and Andrew Dillon and the advisory committee will say, you know, is our policy worth keeping? Is it working? And they'll say, yep, here, they'll get a report from the AFL medical advisor who confidentially will let them know that yeah, there has been, again, I made up the number. Three who were intercepted through the program, put into a counselling program, only had one positive. And no second strike, for example, and therefore it is worthwhile because we've saved those 15 from being repeat users because they accepted they made a mistake. They put their hand up and they're not going continuing. Now, if you got the same, if you're a club doctor, this is where it gets tricky. If you're a club doctor and you've self-reported three times to me in a season, I'm going to get really annoyed with you, Dwayne, right? And I'm going to really kick you up the bum. And so that's where it becomes tricky because I'm still not allowed to report you if you've come to me three times because of the confidentiality. So I'd be really having a heart-to-heart with you and say, Dwayne, I'm not going to keep protecting you. This is not fair. And sadly, I think there's been an occasions of that in the last decade. But it's the AFL never gets told about that either.
So, and it only counts the first time as a strike, doesn't it? So you can report third, fourth, fifth times, but the only your first one is a strike. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is if it's done with the self-reporting.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yes.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. You can self-report 10 times and it goes nowhere except between you and me if you come to me 10 times with the knowledge of it. But if it's done with the illicit drug testing people who can be there on a match day or can be there at training tonight and they test you, the first time it stays confidential and you'll get intervention and a warning. If it's done the second time, so it's not the club doctor doing it, this is the illicit drug people from Dorovich Pathology doing it on behalf of the AFL program. If you have a second one, that's when it hits the news and you get a high fine and a sanction. So you do get a publicly named if you transgress twice under the testing program during the week, but not the independent one done by the clubs.
And anecdotally, I mean, the club doctors you know very well are not going to tell you names and specific cases, but I'm sure you've heard whether there has or hasn't been players saved by this policy. Do you think there has been players saved by this policy?
Yeah, 100%.
For their lives?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I have. Look, I mean, I think the doctor's welfare, you know, the doctors have got a genuine welfare concern for the players. And so they would argue that they've had some really good wins over a period of time for players who were perhaps younger in the system and got caught up in the nightlife and their mates. And it's only happened for a very short time and they've been saved. And I think that's, again, why the doctors are bought into it, because they can see the results of that labour, I suppose, in terms of saving somebody. And, you know, and then, you know, you might still keep talking to that person and you might even target testing, you know, if you've got a good relationship with that player, and because they stay negative, you know you've had a win because they've kept off and they admit that they just went off track accidentally.
Great to have you, Doc. Before you go, Tom Duday, ACL, how long is this second one going to take, and was his recovery sort of on the shorter time frame anyway?
Yeah, look, number nine, I mean, I did a thing yesterday where we talked about the eight so far in the AFL, and I said, look, it'd be really disappointing if I've got to talk about another one in the next week, but it's quite likely because it's early season. It's the player intensity. It's the harder grounds coming off the summer and the warm weather. So there are reasons why you have a spike in the first 4 to 5 rounds. And again, not talking specifically, but certainly coming back within the 12 to 14 month is certainly a much higher risk. And again, this is the time of the year when you're likely to do it. It's like two mountain peaks, Dwayne. You have a rise at the start of the season, then a bit of a valley during the mid-year as players settle down and the intensity and the winter weather comes in, particularly the outdoor stadiums. And then you have a second mountain peak in that August-September time when people are really vying for the finals or getting fatigued. And so the peak we're seeing now is traditional, but nine is a high. I've seen nine before, and we've ended up with 24 or 25 for the season. So that is a really bad start to the season. But I've also seen a high peak where it just dripped away and we only have three more conversations, you and I, for the rest of the year. It's so unpredictable, despite all these years of looking at why ACLs happen. So, but it's a bad start to the year. And these normal starts, we end up with 20-plus. And I think that's a bad sign. But no new news on how to prevent them. Just it's bad luck.
Or don't start. Are you warning the AFL not to start the season as early next year, or don't start it any earlier?
That's been shown to be a factor. And again, if we talk back without going too far off track, the AFL women's season, when it was earlier in the season, remember how we had so many women's ACLs happening, like 10, 12 in a six-week period. And there were multiple reasons why the women have a higher incidence. But part of it was they were playing too early in the season on much harder grounds, much drier grounds. And yes, they're not as strong. And yes, they haven't grown up playing footy since 3 years of age. So there's other reasons. But that sort of high incidence in the season affected the women's season before the AFL looked at putting it at a different time of the year. And I think the earlier we start practice matches, and as I said, if we go back, you've got Dan McStay, you've got Silvani, you've got Doherty, you've got Coleman, you've got Blanche, you've got Gibkiss, you've got Bailey Smith, and now, you know, we've had some really serious ones this year, which I'm hoping it's just a blip, but it has happened before and it always happens. So I don't know whether we just say we're going to start in March. I don't know whether that's, you know, in terms of practice matches, but it would change the whole fabric of the way the season, because they're trying to make a longer season. I don't think the players and the fitness guys want that, Dwayne.
Doc, great to have you. Dr. Peter Larkins, you know the voice. If you know the voice and you know the name and you love what he's got to say, you can read Dr. Peter Larkins' book, which is out. It's called The Healthy 100, 100 Ways to a Healthier, Happier and Longer Life. There's things in there about understanding how and why we age, starting an exercise program and why exercise is medicine, looking after your mental health. It's all there. It's in Dr. Peter Larkin's book, which is out right. It is out now. Doc, when's it out?
It was out on Friday, Dwayne. It's all right. Over the airport. I've had mates. So, yeah, it's in all the major bookstores, Amazon, Booktopia, drpeterlarkins.com. And if you're going through the airport, it's even in the airport bookshops.
As it would be, Doc. In all good bookshops, it should be. The great Dr. Peter Larkins, you can find that book, The Healthy 100. It's even got a preamble by Kathy Freeman. Let me read that. To all you lovers of life who seek a simple yet effective guide to living well beyond 100, read Dr. Peter Larkins' book. Everyone will take away learnings to apply to their own lives from his practical advice. And what a delight it is to have him on to get his practical advice.